The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
This morning I'd like to attempt to take you on a journey back to the time of the Buddha, and to do it with the help of a discourse of the Buddha, one of the ancient discourses called The Fruits of the Contemplative Life. It's one of the very important early discourses. And it also is one of the early discourses that goes back close to the time of the Buddha that is one of the probably the best pieces of early Buddhist literature in terms of the being kind of probably consciously made as a piece of literature rather than just reporting what happened in the time of the Buddha and his teachings. It kind of is crafted. It's a crafted piece. And so I think of it a little bit as being comparable to the plays, Greek tragedy plays, or Shakespeare, and tragedies of Shakespeare, Macbeth or Hamlet or something. And even though it kind of has a good ending, it's still also kind of tragic as well. So it has a certain kind of certain very strong atmosphere. And the teachings of this text has a lot to do, comes about through contrast. There's a lot of contrasts. And you have to get a sense of the contrast to get a sense of kind of what's being accentuated or taught. And I'm reminded of the Japanese flower arrangements where rather than having a big bouquet of flowers, which is sometimes a Western style of lots of flowers, there's only one flower. And that one flower kind of is accentuated, something very special. And that, and so here there's something accentuated through the contrast. And it begins right with the opening, the scene that's laid out. And the scene, as I read it, reminds me of theater. Like, you know, kind of a little bit like Hamlet on the ramparts. Or Juliet in the balcony or something. It's kind of theatrical, so... You know, I think it helps maybe if you're in that kind of capacity to imagine. And what it does is contrasts two settings, two places where people are. It begins by mentioning the Buddha is staying in a mango grove with a large community of monks, 1,250. It's a lot of monks, but 10 times as many as we're here, or more, 10, 12, 13 times as many as we're here. It's a big gathering of people. And if you've ever seen a mango tree, they're beautiful trees, big, lush, green trees, quite big. So it's a big forest of mango trees. So it's a beautiful place, auspicious place. And so it states that's there. And then it transports us at the same time to the palace of King Ajatasattu, king at the time of the Buddha. And it's the full moon in the fall. It's after the rainy season. The temperature in India is pretty good at that point. It's kind of very nice. It's full moon evening. He's on the terrace of his palace with his ministers. So that's that kind of theatrical scene. You know, get a sense of it. And he says to his ministers, how wonderful is this moonlit night. How beautiful, how lovely, how inspiring. How auspicious is this moonlit night. What teachers, spiritual teachers or contemplatives, should we visit tonight who might enlighten and bring peace to our mind? Probably the royal R, my mind. So... that's the scene. And what's and what you don't know, because probably most of you, the Ajatasattu, is that he, in order to become king, he killed his father. So you can imagine how lack of peace he had in his mind. So here he is, kind of agitated, afraid, concerned, something. and he's looking for peace. And he asks, so here we have this contrast, a beautiful moonlit night at both places, but this king who's agitated. And so he asks his ministers, and different ministers recommend different teachers, famous spiritual teachers of the time. And he says, no, not them, not them. And then one minister, didn't say anything. So the king turned to him and said, well, what do you say? Who shall I visit? And this minister, Jivaka, says, well, it just happens to be that in my mango grove right now resides the Buddha with his company of monastics. And a good report has been gone through the land about the Buddha. He's someone who's quite accomplished, enlightened, very wise, skillful. And maybe you should go to him. Maybe he can bring you some peace of mind. So the king thinks, well, that's a good idea. So he says, harness the elephants. And now you have to also think pageantry, you know, theater, because he has 500 female elephants prepared. As well as the king's personal tusker. And having had 500 of his women mounted on the 500 female elephants, I guess he had a big harem. These 500 elephants with 500 women. So it's a big pageant, a big event, a big parade. So again, the contrast. You know, the Buddha was a celibate monk. And this king is going to show up with all his women. And the elephants are the sign of tremendous strength. It's like, you know, it's like showing up with 500 Hummers. You know, to make a certain point. And as they approached, and the attendants were carrying torches, and they headed into this mango grove. But when the king was not far from the mango grove, he was gripped with fear, trepidation, and his hair standing on end. Frightful, agitated, his hair standing on end, he said to his minister, Jivaka, friend, you aren't deceiving me, are you? You aren't betraying me, are you? You aren't turning me over to my enemies, are you? How can there be such a large community of monks, 1,250 in all, with no sound of sneezing, no sound of coughing, no voices at all? So he's afraid of an ambush. This guy's afraid. And the Jivaka says, don't worry. It's all okay. I'm not deceiving you. So then he's willing to get off his elephant, because you don't approach Buddha on your elephant. So he got off and he walked by foot, and he came to the building where the Buddha was, and he was introduced to the Buddha. He said, Buddha's over there. And he sits down, and he says to the Buddha, so he stands there and he surveys the scene of the community of monks sitting in absolute silence, as calm as a lake. So this is a man who's not calm in his heart, right? And this community of people are calm as a lake, really still. Sometimes in here, in this room, it gets really still, even though there's a lot of people. And then he exclaimed, first thing he said, may my son, Udayabada, enjoy the same peace that this community of monks now enjoys. And the Buddha then says, have you come here, great king, together with all your attachments? You know, you come here with all your affections, and meaning he's come to see the Buddha, but he brings along his memory of his son. And the Buddha and the king says, my son is very dear to me. May he enjoy the same peace that this community of monks now enjoys. So the audience of the time is listening to this story. They understand that there's a lot going on here. They're sitting much more alert. Oh, because the audience of the time you know, they know the local history. They would know that his son ended up killing him. So like father, like son, went down. So there's a lot going on here. It doesn't meet the eye as you read this. And he says to the Buddha, I'd like to ask you a question. And the Buddha says, ask as you like. Venerable sir, there are these common craftsmen, elephant trainers, horse trainers, charioteers, archers, camp marshals, commandos, military heroes, bakers, barbers, bath attendants, cooks, garland makers, laundrymen, weavers, basket makers, potters, accountants, and other craftsmen of similar sort. They live off the fruit of their crafts, visible in the here and now. They give happiness and pleasure to themselves, to their parents, wives, and children, to their friends and colleagues. They put in place an excellent presentation of offerings to priests and contemplatives, leading to heaven, resulting in happiness, conducive to a heavenly rebirth. Is it possible, Venerable Sir, to point out a similar fruit of the contemplative life visible here and now? So, you know, some people aren't as polite, you know, good, lousy, you know, monastics who just sit around, you know, looking at your navel, not doing anything productive for society. Can you show any fruit to that life that you live? And what's significant here is that he's contrasting the monastic life, or the contemplative life, with that of craftspeople. Not to himself, who's kind of in a sense inherited or taken over the throne, but he's comparing it to people who develop a craft, who develop a skill. And developing a craft and skill is a capacity we all have, and in some ways a very important capacity, because we all need to develop capacities and skills in order to become adult, and in order to maintain ourselves well into adulthood and old age. Keeping certain skills, developing skills and capacities is part of the task of human life. And there's understanding that with these kinds of crafts, that your efforts are consequential. You can develop a skill. You can improve yourself. You can see the results of that in a variety of different ways. So he says, like a craftsperson who can produce something concrete and tangible and productive for themselves and for society, what is the fruit of the contemplative life, spiritual life? And the Buddha then says, he asks in return, have you ever asked this question of other spiritual teachers? He says, yes, I have. Then if it isn't troublesome for you, can you tell me how they answered? So now the text is going to contrast the teachings of the Buddha eventually with that of the six most popular or important spiritual teachers of his time, as presented by the Buddhists. So it's not, you know. So yes, I approached Purana Kassapa, and I asked him that question. And he said, great king, in acting or getting others to act, in mutilating or getting others to mutilate, in torturing or getting others to torture, in inflicting sorrow or in getting others to inflict sorrow, in tormenting or getting others to torment, in intimidating or getting others to intimidate. This is a spiritual teaching we're getting to. In taking life, taking what is not given, breaking into houses, plundering wealth, and so forth and so forth. If with a razor's edged disc, one were to turn all the living beings on this earth to a single heap of flesh, a single pile of flesh, there would be no evil from that cause, no coming of evil. If you practiced generosity, or getting others to give, make sacrifices, there is no merit from that. There's no benefit from that. So this is a teaching that says that your actions have no effect, that your actions have no meaning, that whether you kill or whether you do merit, nothing happens. There's no action created. Thus, when asked about the fruit of the contemplative life, visible here and now, Purana Kasapa answered with non-action. Just as if a person, when asked about a mango, were to answer with a breadfruit. Or when asked about a breadfruit, were to answer with a mango. So in other words, he didn't answer the question. What's the fruit of the contemplative life? But he offered his teaching of no action. That no matter what you do, whether it's good or bad, it really is no action at all. It doesn't produce any results. It's not good or bad or anything. So then he went to Makali Kosala. And Makali said, "Great king, there is no cause, no requisite condition for the defilement of beings. Beings are defiled without cause, without requisite condition. There is no cause, no requisite condition for the purification of beings. Beings are purified without cause, without requisite condition." Though one might think, through this morality, this practice, this austerity, or this holy life, I will ripen unripened karma and eliminate ripened karma whenever touched by it. That is impossible. So here he says that people's purity, people are defiled or corrupted or somehow have a lot of strong negative attachments, or they have a lot of beauty inside of them. And whether our beauty and our struggles inside are not of our making, don't have a cause or reason, rhyme or reason to them. They're just the way the universe was put together. And we just kind of, the universe is unfolding the way it's going to unfold. And we just happen to be, you know, in a certain stream of cause and effect. And so we become defiled or evil because that's how the universe was created. Or we become pure because that's the way the universe is created. And there's a certain karmic unwinding that has to happen down through time. The momentum has been set at the creation of the universe, and we have to have to wait and let it all unwind. And here it says, it's like just as a ball of string, when thrown, comes to its end simply by unwinding. In the same way, from this endless birth and rebirth, the wise and the foolish alike will put an end to pain. So there is hope. But nothing you can do about it, because it's just going to mechanical kind of unfolding, unrolling of the string of life. Apparently, the king was not satisfied with that, and then he went to a different teacher, Ajita, and he said, "Great king, there is nothing given, nothing offered, nothing sacrificed. There is no fruit or result of good and bad actions." There is no world, no next world, no mother, no father. There's nothing to be realized, nothing to be known. We're just material objects, you know, kind of materialist. We're just object material things that arise and pass. When we die, all the materials of our bodies dissolve into the world again and nothing continues. Nothing really exists. And this is called the doctrine of annihilationism. And this didn't satisfy the king either. So it kind of some kind of radical emptiness teaching. Nothing really exists. This world that we see doesn't really exist the way we know it. There's no, you do good things, do bad things, there's no consequence, it's all empty. Then he went to Pakadu. "Great king, there are these seven substances, unmade, irreducible, uncreated, without a creator, barren, stable as a mountain peak, standing firm like a pillar, that do not alter, do not change, do not interfere with one another, are incapable of causing one another pleasure, pain, or both pleasure and pain." Which seven? So he's saying, fundamentally in this universe, there's only seven real things. Everything else is kind of an illusion. Seven real things. There is the earth substance, the liquid substance, the fire substance, the wind substance, pleasure, pain, and the soul, the Atman, as the seventh. These seven things exist, do not alter. And among them, there is no killer, nor one who causes killing, no hearer, nor one who causes hearing, no cognizer, or one who causes cognition. When one cuts off another person's head, there is no one taking anyone's life. It is simply slicing the knife in between the substances. You know, all these seven different substances. They're all unrelated, they all exist, unalterable. And so you go slice people and just, you know, nothing really happens. So we don't really know if this is what they taught, but this is what the Buddhists want to contrast themselves to. And then there's one more, which I'll... There's a few more, actually. And then one more. I'll read. It's kind of fun. So then he went to Sanjaya Belataputta. And asked the same question. And when he asked the question, the reply was, if you ask me if there exists another world after death, if I thought that there exists another world, I would declare that... Would I declare that to you? I don't think so. I don't think in that way. I don't think otherwise. I don't think not. I don't think not not. So, this is the doctrine of evasion. Of not, kind of being kind of skeptic or not kind of, you know, having any position at all. So again, all these teachers, when asked about a mango, replied about breadfruit. They didn't answer the question. So then he goes to the Buddha and he says, well, now, so now I've come to ask you this question. Is there any fruit to this spiritual life? And the Buddha starts by saying, continues, but he says, I'm going to ask you another question. He says, imagine that there is a slave, that you have a slave or a servant who's diligent, capable, serves you really well, gets up before you, goes to sleep after you, tracks what your needs are, takes care of you really well. And that person, after many years of doing that, reflects, this king lives in luxury, has a good time. What if I do something meritorious, something good, that merit might create some benefit for me? Some good situation for me. So that servant or slave leaves, shaves his head and beard, and becomes a monastic, a renunciant. And in doing that, lives restrained in body, speech, and mind, content with the simplest food and shelter, delighting in solitude. So then imagine that some of your other ministers or servants come to you and say, hey, your servant disappeared and went off and became a monastic and now is an exemplary monastic, living well and content and simple life, ethical life. What would you do? Would you tell your people to bring him back and be a servant again or a slave? And the king said, not at all. Rather, I am the one who would bow down to him, rise up of respect for him, invite him to a seat, invite him to accept gifts of robes, alms food, lodgings, and medicine. And I would provide him with righteous safety, defense, and protection. So what do you think, great king? With that being the case, is there a visible fruit of the contemplative life, or is there not? Yes, venerable sir, said the king. With that being the case, there certainly is a visible fruit of the contemplative life. So you get that? So the Buddha demonstrated to the king that there's fruit from that life. He's treated with respect from the great king. And what a contrast, again, the contrast, right, between being a slave and now being worshipped and honored and made offerings from the king. Then the Buddha does the same thought experiment with a wealthy person. What if that wealthy person in your kingdom went off and became a monastic? How would you treat that person? Oh, that person too, I would treat the same way. I'd bow down to them, make offerings, I'd protect them, I would treat them really well. Is that also a fruit? Yes, that's also a fruit. That's really good. That's pretty neat to have the king, the highest in the land, kind of bowing down to you. It's pretty neat stuff. But then the king says, but isn't there any more fruits than that? So this idea of being honored for your behavior, your change of behavior, is what one of the things being pointed to here. Rather than being honored for who you are inherently, which some people like to do, here what's being honored or pointed to is that a change of ethical status, that a person now living an ethical life, a life of restraint, a life of ethical purity, a life of contentment, of simplicity. And that, in this ancient tradition, is honored and respected to a great degree. So it's what you do here, more than who you are, that is important. So that's important to kind of get as a background for all this. But the king says, but isn't there any more fruit, any more benefits from this contemplative life? And so the Buddha says, oh, there is. And then he's going to lead the king in what we can maybe take as kind of like a guided meditation. So I don't know if I can have the skill to guide you in this way, but if you are, you know, if you're willing to participate with your imagination and imagine that I'm much more eloquent than I am, maybe we could carry you along a little bit in this wonderful guided meditation. Because it grips and carries the king along very nicely. So the Buddha now is going to explain further the fruits of the contemplative life. And he says, at one point, a Buddha appears in this world who teaches the spiritual life that's pure as a polished shell. And a person comes along and hears his teachings, encounters that possibility of a contemplative life, and decides to become a renunciant, shave off my hair and beard, and putting on the ochre robe, and goes forth from the household life into homelessness. So here again we have the contrast between the household life and the homeless life. Back then there were no IMCs, no spirit rocks. There was very little opportunities for the kind of spiritual endeavoring that we have now in our modern society. And really, you know, in order to engage in any kind of serious spiritual life, it almost needed to kind of step out of society as it normally lived. And so this contrast was quite big back then. In our times, I think it's much more gray, and the sharp contrast maybe doesn't exist so strongly anymore. So the person goes off and becomes a monastic. Living a monastic life, the person lives carefully, following the monastic rules, seeing danger in the slightest faults. Consummate in virtue, he guards the doors of his senses, is possessed of mindfulness and alertness, and is content. The person in consummate in virtue, by abandoning taking of life, he dwells laying down the rod, the sword, the knife, scrupulous, merciful, compassionate for the welfare of all beings. So this is the beginning of the contemplative life, to live a compassionate life. Abandoning the taking of what is not given. Abandoning uncelibacy. Abandoning false speech. So he kind of begins to refine his ethics in living ethically pure life. And I imagine that the king was somewhat inspired by this, or moved by this. Remember how ethical the king was. He killed his father. And here he's being what's being described to him is a life that's lived ethically, purely. It must have been quite a contrast for him. And the Buddha goes on, talks about ethical purity. And there's many pages of that. To make the point to the king, I guess. And then he talks to the king about sense restraint. I call it guarding oneself, or safeguarding oneself at the sense doors. Sense restraint kind of has kind of a negative downer feeling to it, but self-guarding oneself at the sense doors. The understanding in the Buddhist spiritual life is that there's something very precious within us, the capacity, the potential for peace, for compassion, for liberation. And that's something that's easily lost track of if we get caught up, obsessed with sense pleasures, caught up with the experiences of the world outside of us. It isn't that we want to reject the world, but it's so easy to kind of get swept away into the world, this world around us. And so a very important Buddhist practice is to be attentive to what comes into you through your sense doors, through your eyes, your ears, your nose, your mouth, all these places. To pay attention there. Notice. Because if you don't pay attention, chances are you'll be swept away by it. So you want to protect or safeguard something that's really beautiful by making sure that when you see something externally beautiful, you don't think about, I'm going to get that, I want that, and get caught up by that, but you're able to stay with the beauty, with the freedom, with the peace that's there. It requires a high degree of mindfulness. In this ancient tradition, a king was supposed to be the epitome of someone who lived unrestrained in the senses. 500 women in his harem, right? And so able to follow through and get any kind of sense delight that he wanted. So this is quite a contrast to the king. And the Buddha is talking about the value of safeguarding oneself at the senses. And then the Buddha continued and talked about someone who's self-possessed with awareness, who is mindful and alert. When they're standing, there's a kind of a presence when they're standing. You can feel, oh, they're present. The person's really present. A presence of mind, a presence of beingness. When they're eating, there's a presence there. They're present. When they're talking, they're present. When they're, whatever they're doing, there's a sense of presence in what they're doing. And maybe, you know, I can imagine the king is so caught up in his pleasures and his wars and his all this stuff that he's caught up in the world that he's trying to create for himself, that he loses touch with himself. There's no presence here. And then this monk cultivates contentment. Just as a bird, wherever it goes, flies with its wings as its only burden, so the monastic is content with a set of robes to provide for his body and alms food to provide for his hunger. Wherever he goes, he takes only his barest necessities along. This is how a monk is content. So isn't that a nice image? Like a bird? Imagine a bird carrying a suitcase. So, traveling light. So, so the renunciant is someone who's let go of a lot. But the important point here is not the letting go, but rather the contentment in that simplicity. So the monk cultivates contentment. So, very important quality for this Buddhist path. Having cultivated contentment, the person then begins addressing, the monastic begins addressing some of the primary ways that the mind, even without sense inputs, can be obsessed with the things of the world. And there's five primary ways that the mind can get caught up, and they're called the five hindrances. Caught up for desires, sensual desires, what we want. Caught up in what we don't want, aversion. Caught up in kind of a confusion of all that, called sloth and torpor, giving up, despair, lethargy. Caught up in restlessness and anxiety. And caught up in doubt. Very powerful forces in the mind. And so a very important part of Buddhist spirituality is to work with these, contend with these, work through these, so these forces in the mind are not there obstructing the clarity of the mind. And the Buddha gives here a beautiful analogies for these, I think. To be caught up in sensual desire is like being caught up in debt. And when you're no longer in debt, you're happy. When you're no longer caught by sensual desire, then you're like free of debt. To be caught up in aversion is like being sick. And when you're freed of your illness, that's like being freed of your anger, animosity, hostility, and all that. When you're caught up in restlessness, sloth and torpor, it's like being in prison. You just can't move, you can't get out, and you can't do anything. And when you're freed of sloth and torpor, it's like being freed of prison. When you're caught up in restlessness and anxiety, it's like being a slave. You're being run and someone else is in charge, not you. And when you're freed from slavery, it's like being freed of restlessness and anxiety. And doubt is likened to being leading a caravan through the desert and being lost in the desert. You know, no water, nothing. And when you finally find your way out of the desert to freedom, into safety, that's like being released from doubt. So the king hears all this. Maybe he's never heard this before. Remember, the other teachers had nothing like this in their teachings. They just declared certain kind of metaphysical principles. And the Buddha here is not declaring a metaphysical principle. He's describing a way of life and a way of practice. Isn't that interesting? Again, the contrast, right, between spiritual teaching versus a spiritual life. And the king asked about the contemplative life, and the Buddha's responding in kind. This is what contemplative life was like. And then with the settling down of these hindrances, then it's possible for the mind to become settled on itself. The mind is not being pulled around by its thoughts into past and future. It's really here and now. And then a very deep settling of the mind is possible in meditation. And a person is possible to start experiencing a tremendous sense of well-being that comes from good, settled, focused concentration, being settled on oneself, being here. Not being divided, not being fragmented, not being cross purposes with oneself, but really fully, fully here, so fully here that you feel a fullness of being, as if nothing else needs to happen. And in that fullness of being, and nothing else needs to happen, undivided attention, there's this deeper and deeper kind of wellsprings of well-being that kind of begin kind of bubbling up and filling a person from the inside out. And then with that kind of deep sense of being settled and at peace, then the person begins to have clear insight, understanding about this life that we live, who I am, what's going on here. Start seeing the nature of how things come together, how our thoughts and motivations work, the nature of impermanence, how we resist impermanence, how we struggle with it, what goes on. So there's a deeper insight that comes. So this deep meditative well-being is not there for its own sake. It's there as a kind of as a way of clearing the deck so we can see really well what's going on here. Seeing really well, then a person begins understanding something about their suffering, something about how suffering arises, the causes of suffering, and what it takes to become free of suffering, what needs to be let go of. And with a deep, settled mind that can see really well, it's possible to see at the very kind of root, the very kind of foundation of our personality, foundation of our psychic structure, how we built psychologically, start seeing what it is we're doing that brings about our suffering. The movement of mind, the neural pathways in the mind that are maybe been reinforced and laid in for lifetimes of activity. You can see how those movements of mind function towards clinging, grasping, and how that grasping leads to our suffering. Not at the surface of the mind that we kind of see, but deep down inside. Because I think many of us have the experience of suffering, and we don't have a clue what this is about. We kind of know, or kind of know someone did something, but to really understand, why am I suffering? Why am I so depressed? Why am I so upset? Why am I so afraid? It's sometimes hard to see the causes and conditions for it. It requires this very deep, settled ability to be concentrated. And in this contemplative life, the Buddha is leading his monastics, and here at least as an act of imagination, the king, through these stages of practice, of changing one's life, to allow for this deep, deep insight to happen. It doesn't happen without being settled on oneself in a deep way, to be content. And with that comes liberation, comes the uprooting of those root clinging. And the person is released, is enlightened, is free, done what had to be done. This too, great king, is a fruit of the contemplative life, visible here and now, more excellent than the previous ones, and more sublime. And as for another visible fruit of the contemplative life, higher and more sublime than this, there is none. So he's led the king. So he starts off with a very simple fruit. Just, you'll treat the guy nicely. Isn't that nice? But the king's not content with that. And then he leads the king to the highest fruit of it all, which is liberation. When this was said, the king said to the Buddha, "Magnificent, venerable sir, magnificent. Just as if he were to place upright what was overturned, to reveal what was hidden, to show the way to one who was lost, or to carry a lamp into the dark so that those with eyes could see forms. In the same way has the Blessed One, through many lines of reasoning, made the Dharma clear. I go to the Buddha for refuge, to the Dharma and the community of monks for refuge. May the Buddha remember me as a lay follower who has gone to him for refuge from this day forward for life." So it's a kind of a conversion experience, kind of. It's really made an impact on the king. And then he goes on, the king says, "A transgression has overcome me, venerable sir, in that I was so foolish, so muddle-headed, and so unskilled as to kill my father. A righteous man, a righteous king, for the sake of sovereign rulership. May the Blessed One please accept this confession of my transgression as such, so that I may restrain myself in the future." "Yes, great king, a transgression overcame you in that you were so foolish, so muddle-headed, and so unskilled as to kill your father, a righteous man. But because you see your transgression as such and make amends in accordance with the Dharma, we accept your confession. For it is a cause of growth in the Dharma when, seeing a transgression as such, one makes amends in accordance with the Dharma and exercises restraint in the future." It's pretty good. When this was said, the king said to the Buddha, "Well then, venerable sir, I am now taking leave. Many are my duties, many my responsibilities." "Then do, great king, what you think it is now time to do." So the king left, delighting and rejoicing in what he heard. Not long afterwards, the Buddha addressed the monks and said, "The king is wounded, monks. The king is incapacitated. Had he not killed his father, that righteous man, that righteous king, the dustless, stainless Dharma eye would have arisen in King Ajatasattu, as he sat in this very seat." So he would have been enlightened. Listening to this teaching, being guided in this guided meditation, the king would have been enlightened. But his crime was so heinous, so great, that this kept him from taking it in as fully as he could. He took it in as much as he could. He became a lay disciple, and then he went back to his important work of being a king. And so on one hand we have the palace life, on the other hand we have the peaceful serenity in the woods, 1,200 people sitting in meditation, completely quiet and still, content, peaceful, self-possessed, filled with well-being, with the capacity to see really deeply into the very nature of this life and who we are, and becoming free. So where will you go now? Back to your palaces or back to the woods? It's up to you. So I hope that worked, to give you a little synopsis of this ancient piece of theater, literature, teaching. And you've now shared in a drama that's been retold for centuries in the Buddhist tradition. So thank you very much.